Remark wrote about going home on leave. Father wants me to tell him about the front. He does not know that a man cannot talk of such things. I would do it willingly, but it is too dangerous for me to put these things into words. And of the uncrossable gap, Remark comments, there is a distance, a veil, between us. He knew that he was not really at home. He had to go back to the front and survive. When Yates had finished checking Simpson, he discovered that his own rope above had caught on something, so he had to climb back up to retrieve it. He recovered and adapted quickly. He saw opportunity in adversity. In a way, it took my mind off things and gave me time to settle into the new situation. Time was of the essence. They had both run out of water and fuel. They had to get down fast or they would both die. So the process of coming to terms with the new world had to take place promptly. They had clamped down hard and sure on the basic tools of survival. Their attitude was cool, open, empathic, and committed. Their approach was orderly, bold yet cautious, inventive. In a moment, it would become playful as well. As Yates began his dangerous, unroped climb to the top, as he later put it, I left him then and forgot about him. Cool turned to cold. That's what it takes. He was fully committed. It is difficult to convey the objective hazard of Simpson and Yates's situation. They were on a snow cliff that wasn't solid enough for the use of conventional ice-climbing tools, such as axes. Coming off the summit, they'd had to plunge-step into it, burying their feet and burying their ice axes, including their arms, just to keep from falling. Even then, the snow gave way, crumbling with their every movement. As they placed their feet on the descent, at each step the snow would compress, and they had no idea when one such slide would simply continue, accelerating into a fall that would have taken them several thousand feet straight down. Now, the slightest mistake could result in death for Simpson, if not Yates as well. Yet they would be called upon to do the most outrageously risky things, and to do them with the utmost caution. Simpson had unroped so that Yates could set up the rappel. Now, with Yates once more beside him, clinging to the face, as Yates tells it, Joe tried moving beside me and very nearly fell off. I grabbed him and put him back into balance. He stayed silent. He knew that if I hadn't grabbed him, he would have fallen off the length of the east face. Indeed, the climb up the edge of the cliff was the hardest and most dangerous thing I'd ever done. Yates arrived at the top, shaking and so strung out that I had to stop still and calm myself. But it was that very ability to remain calm that made what they were about to do possible. As Yates watched, Simpson began traversing upright on the nearly vertical wall of snow. Yates later said, He moved so slowly, planting his axes in deeply until his arms were buried and then making a frightening little hop sideways. He shuffled across the slope, head down, completely enclosed in his own private struggle. It occurred to me that in all likelihood he would fall to his death. I wasn't disturbed by the thought. In a way, I hoped he would fall. I knew I couldn't leave him. If I tried to get him down, I might die with him. Simpson was learning what it means to be playful in such circumstances. A pattern of movements developed after my initial wobbly hops, and I meticulously repeated the pattern. Each pattern made up one step across the slope, and I began to feel detached from everything around me. I thought of nothing but the patterns. His struggle had become a dance, and the dance freed him from the terror of what he had to do. On April 26, 1976, Lauren Elder was a 29-year-old painter living in Oakland, California. Her boyfriend's boss, Jay Fuller, had a four-seat Cessna and had decided to take Elder and his own girlfriend over the mountains to Death Valley for a picnic. Owing to a mistake in navigation, Jay crashed his plane at 12,360 feet on a peak half a mile south of Mount Bradley in the Whitney Quadrangle of the Sierra Nevada. His girlfriend died quickly, and Jay died the next day. Elder was stranded on the icy cliff. As she recounted in her book, And I Alone Survived, in the immediate aftermath of the crash, even as Jay and his girlfriend were dying, something peculiar happened. I got angry. It came simmering up from inside. I thought, that's not going to happen to me. I am going to get down from here. That's not going to happen to me. Anger displaced inertia. She displayed all of the typical features of a successful survivor. Using gasoline from the plane, she kept a fire going all through the icy night. She drank beer that Jay had brought along to keep from being dehydrated. And starting off the next day, wearing high-heeled boots, a short skirt, and no underwear, she climbed and hiked for 36 hours to reach a small California town. She told me, I kept stopping to appreciate how beautiful the place I was in was. There I was in this amazing wilderness, and I had the whole place to myself. She even found time to stop and skinny dip in an icy mountain pool and was moved to cry out with joy. Survival is the celebration of choosing life over death. We know we're going to die. We all die. But survival is saying, perhaps not today. In that sense, survivors don't defeat death. They come to terms with it. Elder didn't require rescue, didn't further injure herself, she'd broken her arm in the crash, and did get out alive. When I spoke to her, she talked of using patterns, as Joe Simpson had. She turned her grueling hike into a dance of joy. Countless survivors have reported the same thing. By developing a pattern and then fixing on nothing but making the pattern perfect, they were able to get out of seemingly impossible situations. Chanting, for example, is a pattern that can alter consciousness and calm the mind. The military uses marching and songs to move troops and keep fatigue and emotions under control. The brain is organized to recognize patterns, language, and numbers among them. They are elemental. Life is, after all, the order inside the chaos. Everything else goes down with entropy. We rise up, and we do it with patterns. Patterns of proteins, rhythms of breathing and heartbeat, patterns of day to night, lunar and menstrual cycles, the regular marks on bone fragments that the first people left behind. To make a pattern, to use rhythms, means quite literally to live. Extraordinary effort in human work has always taken rhythmic play along as its helpmate. It would not be surprising to learn that the first people to cross the Bering Strait danced across, singing a song, even as slaves who were forced to build railroads sang chain gang songs to the ringing of a 9-pound steel. So Joe Simpson had come to accept his situation. He employed an inventive concept to reach the stage of playfulness, and he used that to create a rhythmic pattern to achieve a short-term goal. I knew I was done for, Simpson wrote later. It would make no difference in the long run. But he kept going anyway because of the pattern. Yates appeared on the wall near Simpson, then moved ahead of him to cut a trench that would make Simpson's traverse easier. Simpson continued to repeat his pattern along the trench. He thought, if I ask Simon to help, I might lose this precious thing. I remained silent, but it was no longer for fear of losing control. I felt coldly rational. Epictetus said, and let silence be the general rule, or let only what is necessary be said, and in few words. And rarely, and when the occasion calls, shall we say something. Tom Wolfe wrote in The Right Stuff, one of the greatest sins was chattering or jabbering on the radio. A Navy pilot, in legend at any rate, began shouting, I've got a MiG at zero, a MiG at zero. An irritated voice cut in and said, shut up and die like an aviator. Significantly, an aircraft carrier operation in real combat is called a zip-lip. Simpson was so focused on his patterns that when Yates asked how he was doing, Simpson had forgotten his partner was even there. He lost track of time, too. I had almost forgotten why I was doing the patterns. Only when he was off the cliff to one side did he allow himself the luxury of being afraid once more. Since the accident, they had each done everything right. They had discovered inside of themselves everything a great survivor needs. But they both knew theirs was a precarious position and a fragile state of mind. They were holding something terrifyingly fragile and precious. Now they found themselves on a very steep slope of unconsolidated snow. They worked out a system whereby they would dig a bucket seat in the snow for Yates, and he'd lower Simpson on 250-foot ropes tied together. Then he'd climb down to Simpson, dig another seat, and start over. To succeed, they'd have to repeat that pattern perfectly 10 or 12 times. Recognizing the desperation of their circumstances, Yates lowered Simpson very rapidly. As he did so, Simpson's broken leg caught again and again on the snow, causing him excruciating pain. But neither ever said, "I can't take it anymore." Neither said, "Why me, Lord?" There was no self-pity. Instead of complaining, each time Yates came down to where Simpson waited, digging him another seat, Yates grinned at him. Simpson reported that his confidence was infectious. As Simpson put it, "We had lost the sense of hopelessness that had invaded us at the ice cliff." And all the while, the all-important struggle was taking place in Simpson's mind between two voices. The more battering his leg took, the more one voice begged him to rest, leave me be. But we had locked ourselves into a grim struggle. He stayed inside himself, never looking outside for someone to blame. Instead, his rational, cold voice said, "I could adjust to the steady pain." Weather conditions were worsening. Time was running out, and they were both experiencing hypothermia and frostbite. Their hands were becoming useless. Simpson came to the end of the rope once again and began digging the seat for Yates. To his horror, he discovered solid water ice beneath a small amount of snow. It was a measure of how cold I had become to see how long it took before I thought of hammering an ice screw into the slope, he wrote. Once hypothermia sets in, despite the best efforts, cognition deteriorates quickly. To use Jack London's phrase, the wires were down. Even when the idea at last occurred to Simpson, it took a monumental effort to turn the correct idea into action. He managed to hook the wires back up again. After pounding in the screw as an anchor for the rope, he started exercising to warm himself. That level of cognitive functioning under such circumstances is truly remarkable. At each new pitch, Yates knew how much he was hurting Simpson. He said later, "It was strange being so cold about it, but it was efficient." That was all there was now. To be as efficient at surviving as nature itself was being at taking their lives. Seeing the water ice into which Simpson had pounded the screw, Yates understood that water didn't simply appear in one spot. It had flowed there. The ice would have to be part of a larger formation. There must be something beneath them on the slope. They couldn't see because of the weather. They decided to rappel. After successfully completing the rappel, Yates and Simpson looked at each other, and Simpson later said, "It felt like some cliché from a third-rate war movie." Indeed, it was. That's why Hollywood movies are structured the way they are. It's the reason that heroes in movies are cool and show no emotion while the villains go berserk. And the reason movies have three acts is because survival comes in three acts. In Act 1, you get into trouble. In Act 2, you struggle. In Act 3, you get out. Simpson and Yates were heading for the Act 2 curtain, as it's called among Hollywood scriptwriters, that point at the end of the second act where the hero is farthest from his goal and it appears as if he's done for. In Act 3, with a superhuman struggle and a big chase scene, he overcomes impossible odds and finds redemption and triumph. I've done some Hollywood screenwriting, though not very successfully, and I always wondered why we had to write our scripts to that formula. I obviously knew nothing about why there are movies in the first place. They were so focused now Simpson didn't notice that night had fallen. Or, as Mike Yankovich put it, you're at a quarter mile and someone asks you who your mother is, you don't know. That's how focused you are. Everything was working the way it was supposed to, when one of their mistakes, long forgotten, caught up with them. Zooming down the slope, ignoring the pain, Simpson went straight off the cliff. Having not exactly planned the descent, they had somehow missed that 800-pound gorilla. Simpson now dangled hopelessly over the cliff, unable to reach the ice wall 6 feet away to plant his axe. Far above, Yates's senses were so finely tuned that he could read every trembling vibration in the rope, and now he could tell what Simpson was doing, or rather what he was not doing. He wasn't climbing or standing on anything. He was hanging. This is precisely where they had started. There was no way Yates could pull Simpson up, but now there was also no way for him to get to Simpson. Simpson could neither climb nor descend. Neither could see the other or communicate. Simpson knew Yates's seat was crumbling. None had lasted much longer than the time it took for each of Simpson's rapid descents. Checkmate. The greatest chess master, Mother Nature, does not resign. There was nothing Yates could do, and as his seat let go and he began to fall, he cut the rope. Even then, he did not succumb to emotion. I was actually pleased that I had been strong enough to cut the rope. A lot of people would have died before getting it together to do that. And after all, this isn't about heroism. It's about survival. Once again, Yates had done what was necessary. If it was murder, it was premeditated. He'd even thought to untangle the rope before cutting the line so that it wouldn't catch his foot and pull him down. He was sure Simpson was dead, and that he had killed him. But I felt cold and hard. Simpson fell, and fell for a very long time. The world went black. He landed with a huge concussion. When he came to his senses, he was in a deep crevasse. He had punched through a snowy roof and landed on a snow bridge. His pack and the snow had broken his fall. Aside from his leg, he was miraculously uninjured. But the miracle had left him more stranded than before. Thinking that Simpson was dead, Yates would leave the mountain. It was the Act Two curtain. And yet, when Simpson realized that he was alive, he laughed. A key first move. That the fall hadn't killed him was miraculous. That it hadn't killed his spirit was more so. He lay in a precarious position on a slick and snowy bridge above a long drop into darkness. Simpson began to analyze his situation. Careful not to slide off, he got new batteries out of his pack and put on his headlamp. Working by that light, he managed to squirm around and put an ice screw into the wall nearby. He could see no floor, only blackness below. High above, however, he could see the hole he had punched and a sky furious with stars. As he fought off periodic bursts of emotion, laughter, weeping, Simpson's calm, rational voice spoke to him. The split was working again. The rest of me went quietly mad while this calm voice told me what was happening and left me feeling as if I were split in two. As Simpson had done when he first broke his leg, he spent some time swearing and cursing out loud, his voice echoing off the crystal walls of his ice tomb. Instead of giving in to fear, he used anger to power his actions. But the hole far above him was as unreachable as the stars. At last, Simpson calmly accepted his new world, even while knowing it was impossible to climb out. Epictetus again, lameness is an impediment to the leg, but not to the will. And add this reflection on the occasion of everything that happens, for you will find it an impediment to something else, but not to yourself. So he tried to climb. He was right. It was impossible. Simpson settled on his only other option, lowering himself into the black and unknown abyss. If it was farther down than his rope length, whatever that was now that it had been cut, he'd go off the end and die. He intentionally did not tie the safety knot, because he didn't want to hang there for several days or even hours, dying slowly, and he knew he'd be unable to ascend. Simpson was experiencing what Leach calls the paradox of resignation without giving up. It is survival by surrender. Despite frozen hands, he managed to tie into his ice screw. He hooked in and slipped off his perch with terror pouring through him, barely under control. He was fully committed now to survive or die. Several times on his seemingly eternal rappel, Simpson was seized by panic and simply stopped, hung there, and found himself unable to go on. His mind was swamped by the image of feeling and hearing the rope whiz through the rappel device as he plunged into the bottomless pit. But he managed to keep going, and before the rope ran out, he found himself staring at a floor in the pale yellow light of his lamp. He just hung there for a moment, taking it in. He was aware that it might be a false floor, and he could fall through. Then he noticed an enormous cone had built up from snow sifting in from outside. It was Per Bach's sand pile. The cone started at this deep level and went straight up, narrowing to the hole in the ceiling. Simpson had been unable to see the formation from his previous position above, and anyway, it had been dark. Now he realized the sun had risen. The cone was very steep, but he decided that he could climb it. Besides, there was no choice. That's the whole point about survival. No one would be mad enough to do these things if it weren't absolutely necessary. After that harrowing descent, his brain needed a rest. The organism knows what it wants and finds what it needs. Still hanging on his rope, Simpson began to experience a sense of wonder and even joy at his environment, that same spiritual and mystical transformation reported by Steve Callahan and many other survivors. It is always followed by a certainty of survival and a renewed commitment. With dawn came light, and with light came revelation. A pillar of gold light beamed diagonally from a small hole in the roof, spraying bright reflections off the far wall of the crevasse. I was mesmerized by this beam of sunlight burning through the vaulted ceiling from the real world outside. It had me so fixated that I forgot about the uncertain floor below and let myself slide down the rest of the rope. I was going to reach that sunbeam. I knew it then with absolute certainty. How I would do it and when I would reach it were not considered. I just knew. Lauren Elder and Debbie Kiley both reported similar experiences. Indeed, Christopher Burney's concentration camp experience of seeing summer come was like that, spiritual wonder followed by commitment. Survivors always turn a bad situation into an advantage or at least an opportunity. As Joe Simpson reported, "In seconds my whole outlook changed. I could do something positive. I could crawl and climb. Now I had a plan." Here he was in hell, and he had just glimpsed redemption. The change in me was astonishing. I felt invigorated, full of energy and optimism. Again he laughed out loud. I could see possible dangers, very real risks that could destroy my hopes, but somehow I knew I could overcome them. Good survivors, like good wives, husbands, and CEOs, always consider the bleak side of things, too. They plan for them and have an earnest hope that they will manage. But they do not care overly much that they might not. They accept that to succumb is always a possibility and is ultimately their fate. They know safety is an illusion, and being obsessed with safety is a sickness. They have a frank relationship with risk, which is the essence of life. They don't need others to take care of them. They are used to caring for themselves and facing the inherent hazards of life. So when something big happens, when they are in deep trouble, it is just more of the same, and they proceed in more or less the same way. They endure. Simpson knew where he was and where he was going. He fixed a goal. What else do we ever do? Survival is nothing more than an ordinary life well lived in extreme circumstances. He embraced the world, and the world embraced him. He was not lost, so all was not lost. And as we learned from Ken Killip, not being lost is not a matter of getting back to where you started from. It is a decision not to be lost wherever you happen to find yourself. It's simply saying, I'm not lost, I'm right here, which is, significantly, what a child would say. Zen mind. Beginner's mind. As Simpson prepared to climb, to project himself into a future that he had made as real as the past, he took in his environment, drew in its strength and beauty once more. For all its hushed, cold menace, there was a feeling of sacredness about the chamber, with its magnificent vaulted crystal ceiling, its gleaming walls encrusted with myriad fallen stones. It had me now, and without the sunbeams I might have sat there numbed and defeated. But, of course, the sunbeams are always there. The trick is in seeing them. At such times, facing their biggest challenge, survivors also find that they even feel lucky. After catching a fish, Steve Callahan wrote, I sit 1,000 miles away from any companionship, money, or luxury, yet I have a feeling of wealth. Joe Simpson said that he kept telling myself that I was lucky to have found a slope at all. Saint-Exupéry's plane went down in the Libyan desert, a circumstance at least as grave as Simpson's. He wrote in Airman's Odyssey, Here we are, condemned to death, and still the certainty of dying cannot compare with the pleasure I am feeling. The joy I take from this half an orange which I am holding in my hand is one of the greatest joys I have ever known. At no time did he stop to bemoan his fate, or if he did, it was only to laugh at himself. So Simpson returned to his old friend, the patterns and rhythms of the dance. He'd place his ice tools, plant his good foot, then pull hard while hopping upward to plant the foot a bit higher up. Bend, hop, rest. Bend, hop, rest. He found once more that concentrating on the pattern helped him ignore the pain. At the same time that he took the greatest risk, he was also safeguarding himself. I resisted the urge to look up or down. I knew that I was making desperately slow progress, and I didn't want to be reminded of it by seeing the sunbeam still far above me. Interesting. For how can you know something and still keep from reminding yourself of it? It would seem to be a paradox, unless you had two brains. Indeed, when Simpson says he knew, he means that his hippocampus contained a short-term memory pattern about his situation. But the visual perception of how far he had to go would be sent straight down through the thalamus to the amygdala to be screened, and that was what he wished to avoid, because it might trigger a whole new set of emotions that he didn't need right now. He could bump what was in working memory out by concentrating on something else, his pattern. It was a wise choice. Keep the perceptual input to a minimum right now. Don't feed that amygdala any scary raw data. Simpson had been in the crevasse for 12 hours when he stuck his head out of the hole and into the sunlight to see beauty I had never noticed before. Once fully out, he collapsed in the snow, releasing his tight grip on himself at last. That lock he had on himself could be relaxed for a little while. Not too long, but he deserved a rest. It was only then that Simpson realized what he already knew. He was still very high on the mountain, 6 miles above the campsite and help, and he had a broken leg. He was exhausted, dehydrated, hypothermic, frostbitten, and had just used his last ice screw. Since he was officially dead, no one would come looking for him. How the hell, he began to wonder, would he get out? All at once it seemed that there was some sort of dark, malevolent force to this place, dogging him personally. In Lord Jim, Joseph Conrad describes these elemental furies coming at him with a purpose of malice, which means to sweep the whole precious world utterly away from his sight by the simple and appalling fact of taking his life. Simpson had protected himself from such thoughts while climbing out of the crevasse. If he thought of death, he might not have bothered. Like walling off Pareback's sandpile against collapse, he'd compartmentalized and set his short-term goal, not even that of climbing the cone, but of doing each pattern meticulously, one step at a time. Thus he had been able to go boldly into the unknown. Now he faced a new unknown, somehow to cover the impossibly rugged 6 miles to camp. His situation seemed every bit as hopeless as it had been down in the hole. That's why a survivor must compartmentalize and set small goals. It would kill him not to. Simpson felt crushed as he realized that the movie had to start over. The friggin' movie! Right from the first stupid cliched reel. It was enough to make you do what all good survivors do. He laughed at himself. "This is getting ridiculous," he said out loud. "You become like a slapstick version of yourself, taking pratfalls and suffering impossible abuses, like Laurel and Hardy getting run over by a steamroller and getting back up again. That's why we love to see comic characters suffer. Charlie Chaplin is survival training, after all. To laugh at our own misfortune, we must be willing to play the fool. It keeps us from taking ourselves too seriously. It keeps us humble." Simpson took a last look around and accepted that he would almost certainly die out here. From long habit, he was able to view his own death dispassionately. But he wouldn't die without a struggle. He had something left to risk, so he would risk it. A survivor builds up an account of commitment over a lifetime. The more he invests, the more he has when trouble comes. Now Simpson felt his senses grow sharp and alert. Like Callahan, he saw himself, humbly, with spiritual empathy and even gratitude, as a part of this sweet old world. He looked across the immense broken landscape he had to cross, looked ahead at the land stretching into distant haze, and saw my part in it with a greater clarity and honesty than I had ever experienced before. An excited tingle ran down my spine. I was committed. The game had taken over. He felt honored to be in a tournament with the greatest chess player of all. With the practice he'd had during the past few crises, and through the years as an extreme mountaineer, Simpson was able to reconsolidate rapidly. He went through all the stages and organized his attitudes and actions. His initial horror, anger, and depression at realizing how far he was from success rapidly turned into a will and a plan. His mind split once again. His perceptions became sharp as he accepted his world and embraced the immediate tasks ahead of him. He was back inside himself. "There were no dark forces acting against me," he realized. A voice in my head told me that this was true, cutting through the jumble in my mind with its coldly rational sound. He listened to the rational one, which directed correct action, while the other mind rambled out a disconnected series of images and memories and hopes, which I attended to in a daydream state as I set about obeying the orders of the voice. He fashioned a splint and used his ice axe as a cane. The patterns took over once more. Place, lift, brace, hop. Place, lift, brace, hop. He could actually hear the rational voice, while the other was just a tangle of feelings. The neocortex has connections to the auditory thalamus, too, and if you can make it overpower the amygdala and tone down the hippocampal memories, then that's what you hear, a rational voice, clean and sharp and commanding. Every survivor hears the voice. Remarque wrote, "A clear voice utters words that bring me peace to me, a soldier in big boots." Yet, despite the noble struggle and the correct actions, despite his great attitude, Joe Simpson was dying. Nature's forces are limitless. Human energy is not. The various stresses and assaults had overwhelmed his thinking. Gradually, he began to lose that fine balance between the emotional drive to action and his overall cognitive control. Simpson began wandering. He pressed on longer than he should have that night. His energy was getting dangerously low. Then he became lost and no longer knew the way. Now he was going through the stages of getting lost, which were for him, at last, the stages of dying. By chance, on his meandering path, he blundered into a snow slope. The far-off voice spoke up at last, and Simpson dug a snow cave for the night and gave in to fatigue. He awoke in the morning, quoting Shakespeare to himself, shouting at the roof of his snow cave. I felt delighted, bellowing the words in my best Laurence Olivier voice. When the brain is allowed to relax its grip on the survival struggle for a moment, as we've seen, it eagerly gets to work. And where there is no new input to process, to map or memorize, it jumps up and gives you a core dump. That's when you'd better hope you've spent your life building a core. But Simpson was still in grave danger. He'd exhausted himself badly the night before. Fatigue is mysterious and profound. You don't just sleep it off. He needed water, food, and advanced life support for his injuries. As he hobbled on, he made an effort to find his patterns again. But pain and thirst were now tormenting him. He had worked out a system of going from rock to rock, timing himself between those short-term goals to keep working memory occupied. But his resistance was dwindling. Thoughts of the flowing water at a stream heat scene on the ascent preyed on his mind. The logical voice faded even as that other, more disorganized voice urged him on. Go now. Hurry. Water is just ahead. Simpson stopped timing his moves and scrambled on, just to get to water as fast as possible. Night fell again, and he still had not found water. Another whole day had passed. Then his headlamp failed. Hobbling on the makeshift splint, he fell and could not get up. He lay on the rocks where he'd collapsed and slept only fitfully. It was as if the cognitive part of his brain, once freed from the effort of control, got busy doing what it normally did. Now that I was safe to sleep, I felt sharply awake. All the fear he had resisted came flooding in once those emotional parts of his brain were freed from their leash. The pain in his leg, which he'd been suppressing, surged back into consciousness to torment him. All the worries that he'd kept at bay now plagued him. The next day, I had hit some sort of wall. His energy was gone. His will was slipping away. He lay idling, unable to move. But then he thought of Yeats, and remembered that Yeats believed he was dead. There would be no reason for him to stay on the mountain. He'd leave their camp. Even if Simpson managed to get there, he'd die. The certainty of death suddenly energized Simpson. I must reach camp today, he told himself. At that moment, Yeats was burning Simpson's clothes and packing up to return home. Simpson knew that he had 10 hours of daylight left. He recognized, as Steve Callahan had, the need to do everything perfectly. He began to break those hours into short stages, each one carefully timed. Once more, using his anger as a spur, he forced himself into a rigorous pattern, rhythm, and schedule of motion across terrain that would have given any two-legged hiker trouble. He almost didn't make it for any number of reasons. Never underestimate the need for an adult portion of luck. If you get a lucky break, you have to really use it, he later told Backpacker magazine. You have to fight like a bastard. You can't just sit there and wait to get lucky. It doesn't happen. Yeats was about to leave. The locals were bringing up the burros. Simpson was succumbing to dehydration and fatigue as he literally flopped around on the rocks just beyond their camp. At last he managed to seize control of his parched throat and cry out. Yeats heard the cry but did not believe it possible. He went to investigate. Simpson was taken out of the Peruvian Andes on a donkey. He's been on a dozen Himalayan climbs since then. And the route that Simpson and Yates took up Siula Grande has never been repeated. 14. A certain nobility. One day I was chilling in Beaver Flight at Randolph Air Force Base during a weather standby. We couldn't fly because of a thunderstorm. I was idling around, reading a sign on the bulletin board that said, "I want to die in my sleep like my grandfather." And then, in smaller letters, "not yelling and screaming like the passengers in his car." Typical fighter pilot humor. Their group was technically known as Bravo Flight, Bravo being the semaphore designator for the letter B. I heard a pilot named Chuck come in, a fun guy, buzz cut with a square head and shoulders, and like the rest of us, not too tall. Chuck had left Iceland and his F-15 Eagle to become an instructor. He told me about how he and the other Air Force pilots would play chicken at night with the Russians. Then these big Russian ships would come along with multi-million candle power lights to blind them. We couldn't see a fucking thing for like half an hour after that, he told me. It was all a game of nerves. There was no shooting allowed, which presumably would have triggered World War III, but you could die just by losing your cool. It was nasty work. The glory of the sky is one thing, but those guys had to sit for endless hours, most of them uneventful, pissing through a tube into their piddle pack with a rubber mask over their faces, or not. The temperature in the tiny cockpit was either way too hot or way too cold. Food was out of the question, except perhaps for a stolen snack. I'd made some long flights in fighter aircraft and knew how heavy that helmet got, too. We wore a silk skullcap, but it did little good. After an hour, it felt like a hot iron was sitting in the center of my skull, and the weight of it gradually compressed the discs in my neck until the ache went all the way down my back. The helmet and face mask have to be specially fitted, so before I flew, one of the life support crew measured my face with calipers from the bridge of my nose to the tip of my chin. They must be tight, because the wicked wind you meet upon ejecting can blow them right off if they're not. So your head and face are in a vice, too. Nomex gloves, jump boots, Nomex clothing, including a closed collar to keep the flames from burning exposed skin. It was like being swathed in saran wrap. And there was only one position the body could be in because feet, hands, and head were all required to fly. Yes, you could use autopilot and you could even get buck naked over Kuwait, but few did. After a couple of hours, even your teeth hurt. And that's before anything bad happened. Everybody wanted to get into F-15s, but everybody wanted to go home after a while, too. I certainly understood why Chuck had come here as a student IP. The job of the 12th Flying Training Wing at Randolph was to turn experienced fighter pilots into instructors to train other fighter pilots. There would be short flights, long, lazy days of briefings in the classroom, and playing crud, pool played without cues or rules, with the other guys at Friday night beer call in the officers' club. It was a pretty cushy job, although, as my instructor, Captain Stuart Rogers, told me, "We're teaching these trainees the only form of combat flying where the enemy is going to be in the cockpit with you." What he meant was that the instructor of the IP trainee would pretend to be a new student pilot, while the trainee pretended to be his instructor. And the pretend student pilot would try to do something so stupid that it would kill them both, while the trainee tried to anticipate his moves and stop him before it got serious. I just asked Chuck about the pay, and he turned from our conversation and shouted out to the room in general, "Anybody who's doing this for the money, raise your hand." Everybody laughed. Chuck swore that the guy who drove us across the ramp to the airplanes in a blue van every morning made more money than the pilots. Chuck had been doing dissimilar air combat for 3 years. He and three other Eagle drivers would take off and fly out over the ocean, not knowing what they'd meet. Somewhere out there, they'd run into a bunch of Navy guys whose job it was to simulate bandits and bogeys, Soviets at the time. Some even had a few real MiGs, too. When the dogfight started, with planes closing at supersonic speeds, all of the aircraft turned in on one another at once. Everyone was trying to get on someone else's tail, creating a mess they called a furball. On that rainy day in Beaver Flight, we sat watching a video of two planes in just such a simulated dogfight. The pilots in B Flight gathered around the TV and watched the sequence over and over, listening carefully to the radio transmissions, which told the story of what those pilots did in an emergency of amazing proportions, a mid-air collision in a dogfight. The first trans was the leader calling, "Knock it off, knock it off, knock it off," which was the standard order to disengage from the furball. Emergency transmissions are always sent three times, as in "Mayday, Mayday, Mayday." We saw the two planes on the screen glide past each other, shearing off body parts with splashes of smoke like the strokes of a Japanese sumiye brush. Then one of the pilots who was hit called, "Bailout, bailout, bailout." And a moment later, "Mark." Then, bang, his seat fired in a plume of smoke and he was out. "That's just pure polish," Chuck told me. "In a situation like that, your only responsibility is to get out." But he said "mark" so they'd mark his position when he ejected to make it easier to find him. That's just pure professionalism. Pure professionalism. That's what survival is all about. At the core of that pilot's professionalism was the fact that he thought of his teammates in the direst of emergencies. He was not a victim. Madeline Amy Sweeney, a flight attendant on American Airlines Flight 11 on September 11, 2001, demonstrated the same sort of pure professionalism as she sat in a rear seat and calmly reported over the phone what was going on inside the plane that was about to hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center. As her flight service manager heard her describe a passenger having his throat slit, the position of the hijackers, and other important information that would never have gotten out otherwise, he could not help but be impressed by her remarkable control. Like the fighter pilot who ejected, she was what Peter Leshak calls a player, a fighter and helper from beginning to end. It is one thing to say it, another to do it, and yet another still to do it in the clutch of mortal risk. Ejecting from an airplane is not a trivial matter. It is a violent, dangerous, and catastrophic maneuver, like sitting on a stick of dynamite. It often breaks the pilot's back and puts him permanently out of the service. It can promptly remove elbows, knees, and other body parts, and if not done correctly, it can kill you. The pilots know that and are often more afraid to eject than to ride a crippled plane down to a crash landing. Therefore, when they reach down or up to pull the handle, it feels a bit like placing a gun to your own head and preparing to pull the trigger. This pilot, whose plane was catastrophically disabled, knew that he must either crash and die or else pull the handle and risk landing in the sea critically injured with the attendant possibility of drowning. In that terrible moment, he thought of his crew and gave them the one thing they needed to avoid getting themselves hurt while trying to save him, his position. In his neurological researches, Joseph Ledoux wrote, "One of the reasons that cognition is so useful a part of the mental arsenal is that it allows this shift from reaction to action. The survival advantages that come from being able to make this shift may have been an important ingredient that shaped the evolutionary elaboration of cognition in mammals and the explosion of cognition in primates, especially humans." When Neanderthals and the weaker Homo sapiens found themselves in the same environment 100,000 or so years ago, Neanderthals went extinct, but we survived. And that higher cognition may have made all the difference. In the complex technological world we've created, cognition, problem-solving, becomes more and more important for our continued existence. So we come to depend on it as if it were infallible. But that strategy often gives an illusory sense of control that fails us in moments of crisis. Its stepwise linearity is no match for nonlinear dynamic systems, which can behave in turbulent, unpredictable ways, making quantum leaps as they rapidly change their nature. At the moment of truth that defines survivors, and if reason is the only tool at your disposal, you are likely to achieve what David Ruel, a Belgian physicist and one of the founders of chaos theory, referred to as the steady state of death. In Herodotus's histories, Solon of Athens visits Croesus, who shows him his vast treasuries and then says, "My dear guest from Athens, we have often heard about you in Sardis. You are famous for your learning and your travels. We hear that you love knowledge and have journeyed far and wide to see the world. So I really want to ask you whether you have ever come across anyone who is happier than everyone else." Croesus expects to be nominated for the position, but Solon instead names an ordinary man, Tellus of Athens. "You see," Solon explains to the shocked king, "in a battle at Eleusis between Athens and her neighbors, he stepped into the breach and made the enemy turn tail and flee. He died, but his death was splendid, and the Athenians awarded him a public funeral on the spot where he fell and greatly honored him." When Croesus grows angry at not being named the happiest man in the world, Solon counsels him. "I won't be in a position to say what you're asking me to say about you until I find out that you died well. You see, someone with vast wealth is no better off than someone who lives from day to day, unless good fortune attends him and sees to it that, when he dies well and with all his advantages intact. It is necessary to consider the end of anything, however, and to see how it will turn out, because the god often offers prosperity to men, but then destroys them utterly and completely." So it is with the paradox of survival. There is no one point at which a man or woman can be said to have survived and be a perfect survivor until he or she is dead, for each test is a preparation for the next. By its very nature, a survival situation, like life itself, comes upon you unexpectedly. So, only if a life is lived in its entirety as an act of survival can you have a hope of finding correct action at the moment of crisis. Survival is a path that must be walked from birth to death. It is a way of life. Asked to judge a life, Solon chose to judge one that was complete. Ancient books of wisdom often treat issues that bear directly on survival. The Tao Te Ching is filled with glorious paradoxes and compelling mysteries. The ways that can be walked are not the eternal way. The names that can be named are not the eternal name. Plunging into it with the expectation that you will be told what to do is a frustrating experience. The book is meant to lead to revelation, but the path is long. As St. Paul the Apostle wrote, "You must work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." There is instant wilderness, but no instant survival. The Tao Te Ching does not contain salvation, but the way can be followed with integrity. The text explains survival in this way. "One who is good at preserving life does not avoid tigers and rhinoceroses when he walks in the hills, nor does he put on armor and take up weapons when he enters battle. The rhinoceros has no place to jab its horn. The tiger has no place to fasten its claws. Weapons have no place to admit their blades. Now, what is the reason for this? Because on him there are no mortal spots." How to achieve that state is the key to and the central mystery of survival. To be, as Peter Leszak put it, "so alive you simply cannot die." He has survived 21 seasons, 560 fires in 11 states and one Canadian province, because I've tapped into the spiritual aspects of working fire. That is not what you'd expect to be told in training, nor to hear from a tough blue-collar firefighting helicopter boss who works his rough crews on hellacious wilderness fires. "There is a core of mystery and faith that has guided not only my career but also my life," he writes. "To me, the fire ground is a sacred locale, a place of power that is rich not only in tradition, history, and ecological imperatives, but also in sources of emotion and meditations that I can only describe in terms of reverence and awe. Leshak's sense of wealth and wonder in the face of a calamity that could easily include his own death is typical of the best survivors. To revere pain and fear, to embrace friction, are bedrock skills of survival. Leshak, who left behind his schooling for the ministry in order to risk his life routinely as a firefighter, reflects, "I've become a minister after all. I've struck a wellspring of spiritual inspiration and practice." One of the reasons that astronauts are so good at what they do and have so few fatal accidents is that they, too, have struck that wellspring. They are ministers. They are cloistered at Johnson Space Center in Houston for their training. They lead ascetic lives of denial and service. They learn to function as a team, to value their brothers and sisters above their own lives, and to protect them. They learn to become intimate with fear and pain, to make fear and pain tools of their salvation. They train for years and years, knowing that they may never even get the chance to fly. Like the student who wanted to become a Zen swordsman, they are forced to toil and endure the blows of their masters until they no longer need swordsmanship. Only then are they worthy to hold the sword. The selection process at NASA seeks out those who are already on that path when they arrive. Whatever an astronaut is, he is not made that way by NASA. He arrives with it in his heart, and the purpose of his training is to extend and deepen those transcendent qualities. When Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, he had to take control away from Eagle and fly by the seat of his pants. The expression isn't gratuitous. It means that he had to engage his body, read emotions, as well as his thinking with the machine, read the environment. In the ministry of NASA, he had trained his emotions as well as his reason. Thinking too much or too little would not do. Here was a moment of truth in which correct action would arise only out of a perfect blending of the linear and nonlinear, reason and emotion, those instant emotional bookmarks. The proof that logic could not lead to correct action was that Eagle had been set up as an automated, logical system. The computer had a program to follow all the way to the surface of the moon. Armstrong had trained assiduously to land it by hand, but the plan was that Eagle would land itself and he would simply monitor the systems. When Armstrong saw that Eagle was going to land in a boulder field, he knew that logic had failed at the critical moment. He took the controls. As he piloted Eagle down toward the surface of the moon, numerous things went wrong and alarms were blaring in his ears. When he approached to within 1,000 feet of the surface, he saw the area where he intended to land. A crater as big as a football field was just ahead, surrounded by a field of boulders, some as big as Volkswagens, according to Andrew Chaikin's A Man on the Moon. Even as he flew past that spot, using precious fuel, Armstrong found no place to land. His heart rate had gone from 77 to 156 beats per minute, clearly showing that his emotional systems were fully engaged. But his voice was calm. By logic, he should have aborted the mission. There wasn't enough fuel and there wasn't enough time. But logic knows nothing of glory. He was using the spiritual bounty from the ministry of his long training, and the output flowed as rapid-fire bursts of energy from numerous neural networks, animating dynamic models of his world with emotional bookmarks and rational thoughts in ever-changing combinations to keep Armstrong's feet, hands, and eyes moving in such a way as to keep Eagle ahead of the changes in the dynamic system involving mass, momentum, speed, gravity, burn rate, and the fast-approaching lunar surface. The event was literally flowing through him and out of him. He was processing the world and adapting to it at a fantastic rate. And he was doing it in what Leshak calls a tenaciously unforgiving environment, which is what made his performance so remarkable. At the same time that he was engaged with that ineffable flow of survival actions, the ballast of his reason held fast, and he was able to quiet the alarm bells, both from the ship and from inside his emotional system. Neurologically speaking, it was an Olympian performance. He chose another area to land, but it